Live from Chicago, this is Rich Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of room and innuendo, all offered up by a panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by conservative Marty Garrity, liberal Michael Golnick, and Charles Lipson of the University of Chicago. A program tonight coming to you from our home base on State Street, that great street in Chicago where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, our email address is btbtalk@aol.com. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, the website is www.beyondthebeltway.com. Well, today when I was watching Sunday morning television show, the public affairs shows, as many of you saw, former President Bush and former President Clinton talking about the tsunami aid. They were doing live interviews on a couple of the shows, live from Sri Lanka. And here you had a former Democrat, a former Republican, one man who replaced the other, and now joined together by history and a request by the current president to do something about raising money and raising awareness of what's going on insofar as the tsunami victims. And then a little bit later on, Meet the Press, you had Hillary Rodham Clinton, the Democrat from New York, and John McCain, the Republican from Arizona, doing a live interview with Tim Russert on Meet the Press. And that was a love match, listening to the two of them go back. They almost endorsed each other for president, certainly acknowledged that they were qualified to lead this nation. And after listening to both interviews, it really hit me that what a wonderful world it would be if our leaders could all get along that well. But then about an hour later, I said, wait a minute, you know what, maybe that's not a good idea. And so that's going to be one of our topics of tonight, this sense of a bipartisanship. And I guess we're going to explore the likelihood of bipartisanship and whether it's a good idea. We're going to examine if media fuels the discontent that we have in the country. And we're also going to debate, picking up what we talked about last week, should the United States make the rules of the world insofar as who gets to keep atomic weapons and who does not. Marty Garrity is our card-carrying conservative tonight, also a Republican. Marty, on the issue of bipartisanship, is it all that it's cracked up to be?
I don't think so. I think that it's healthy for the republic when the parties battle over important issues. And frankly, I don't think it's really possible either, because our election cycle now runs 4 years, and in the Senate it runs 6 years. The first thing you do when you get elected to the U.S. Senate is you start raising money for your next campaign. And so the notion that Democrats and Republicans are going to be all lovey-dovey with each other, it's hard to imagine, and I'm not so sure that the country would be better off if they were constantly working together, if they weren't trying to identify the things that differentiate them and put those things into law.
Our liberal tonight is Michael Golnick. He is a talk show host for ESPN Radio in Chicago and active in Democratic politics as well. Mike, what's your reaction?
You know, watching the interview that you talked about with Hillary and McCain, it was funny because every single answer began with, well, first of all, I agree completely with, whether it was Senator McCain or Senator Graham, who was also there. It struck me as being very interesting, and I think what Senator Clinton was doing was positioning herself already for 2008. She's moving herself over to the right a little bit, making herself more of a moderate, appealing Democrat to some of those that might have voted for the Republican ticket but would be willing to come back to the Democratic side. As far as bipartisanship is concerned, with Howard Dean as the head of the DNC, I'd say the chances of that happening are far less now than they were before, because obviously there's a lot of strong factions of the Democratic Party that are trying to pull it more to the left and would be very upset if the party began to kowtow to the Republican Party in any way, shape, or form. So with Nancy Pelosi leading the party and Howard Dean leading the party, I think any thoughts of that would be out the window.
Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago also joins us. Charles, is that what the public may really want, though? I mean, we look at one of the most popular figures in politics today. It's John McCain. He's been very popular for a long time. And if there's a guy who's pretty close to being bipartisan, it's him.
That's true. But you know who the most popular quarterback for the Bears is? Always the number two quarterback. He's the one who's going to come in. He's not out there actually making policy right now. I think that the public is actually divided on this, Bruce. I think that on the one hand, they want They do want an opposition party to oppose, but they want it. But they also want effective public policy, and they don't want it to oppose on everything all the time, especially on issues once they feel that the issue has been fundamentally decided. That is, once you've gone into war, they want at least for a while a kind of hiatus of support for that. And,
what about an election? I mean, the election is the way we choose our rulers. I mean, should there be a cooling off period? Should there be a moratorium? You know, should the proverbial honeymoon last more than, you know, 10 days?
No, well, the election is where we, or the presidential election is where we elected our president. But as every senator and member of the House will also tell you, that's when we elected them, too. I think that the toughest issues have to do with, right now, have to do with advice and consent. And the possible issue of a filibuster, in my sense, is that the public will be ill-served if they get a lot of filibusters, if there's a feeling that in Washington they can't actually act.
Mike, should a president get the team that he wants or she wants?
I think to a large extent the president should get the team that he or she wants, but I think there are definitely exceptions. I don't blame the Democratic Party for questioning nominees like Gonzalez. I don't blame the Democratic Party for standing up to that, but I think that it served the Democratic Party not to fight it to the point where it became a distraction for everything else. I think that, you know, as Charles just alluded to, you know, as far as the presidential election is concerned, this president is a very divisive president. You either love this guy or you dislike this guy. So I think with that in mind, it's very difficult to, you know, have that honeymoon period that you spoke of.
Mike, can I ask you a question? It seems like the last, it wasn't so true maybe with Bush the father, but Clinton was very divisive too. Mm-hmm. Do you think it's just become part of our politics now that whoever's the president's going to be divisive?
I think it might just be the circumstances and the personalities of these guys. I mean, Clinton was a guy that for some reason just drew the wrath of the right wing, and I think the reason he drew the wrath of the right wing is because he was so popular. Now you've got a guy in George W. Bush whose popularity is pretty steadfast among the people that support him, and then a guy has just won another term. Obviously, we're stuck with him, for better or for worse, depending on your viewpoint, for the next 4 years. So I don't think it's impossible to have a president who actually is liked by both sides, but the last two just don't fit that bill.
Marty, what about, you want to follow up on that? I kind of broaden the question on the divisiveness. Is it something that George Bush is? I mean, did he go to Washington trying to be divisive?
Well,
he said he was a uniter, not a divider.
I guess it's always interesting to me that Democrats use this term divisive to identify somebody who disagrees with them. And no matter how far off to the left they are, if you disagree with a Democrat, you're divisive. Clinton was a very divisive fellow. Nancy Pelosi, Howard Dean, these are all very divisive people. If you define divisive as taking a position and then fighting for it. And George Bush happily believes what he believes, and he's fighting for it.
We've got a pause. 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border. What do you think? Bipartisanship, where everybody gets along for the good of the country. Do you buy it? Do you want it? 1-800-723-8029. Back shortly from Chicago.
America is a country of entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner, you're helping shoulder the lion's share of the U.S. economy. You can lighten that load a little at Sam's Club. To save you time, we offer click and pull and fax and pull. Place your order online at samsclub.com or by fax before 5 p.m. And at no extra charge, it's ready to pick up the next morning. Now that's teamwork, and we're proud to be a small part of your team. Sam's Club. We are in business for small business.
It's ironic. They're called answering machines, but they never give you answers. Oh, sure, they tell you so-and-so isn't here right now, but you have no idea where they went or when they'll be back. Of course, with GEICO, you won't talk to an answering machine. They have thousands of car insurance specialists standing by, so you always get answers from a real live person. No wondering, no waiting, no irony.
GEICO's customer satisfaction stands at 97%. How would you rate your car insurance company? GEICO, 1-800-947-AUTO.
From Taylorville, Illinois, to Phoenix City, Alabama, you are listening to Beyond the Beltway. 1-800-723-8289 is the phone number. Let's go to Herb listening to us in Willowbrook, Illinois, on WLS. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Thank you, Bruce. Regarding this divisiveness in government, my question is, the president has repeatedly stated at press conferences, I will not debate with myself, which means he is sticking to his positions and he's not willing to compromise. But I think this all centers on this latest debate about reforming Social Security, which I really think is a Trojan horse. There's a considerable body of information now from Bush's former cabinet members like Paul O'Neill, who stated in his book, before he was removed from the Bush White House, that there's no need for Social Security, that people during the course of their working life should put aside enough money to care for themselves in retirement, and Social Security is unnecessary. I fail to see how Social Security can be reformed by removing $1 trillion from the trust fund and setting up private accounts. They're already private accounts. They're called KEOs and IRAs. So I would apply to President Bush what the Nixon people used to say about President Nixon, watch what we do, not what we say. And I think basically compromise is what makes this country great. But I really don't believe that the Bush administration is concerned with compromise. They have an agenda, and they're going to push it to the exclusion of all other ideas.
Mike is shaking his head yes as you speak.
Yeah, because I agreed with what he said about the Bush administration not being interested in compromise. And the very first thing he said during his call about, you know, Bush won't debate with himself. Yeah, he stands firm, and that's what's made him the darling of the Republican Party. But the bottom line is, it's one thing to stand firm if you're right. It's another thing to stand firm if you're wrong. And history has proven so far that Bush has been wrong on a lot of things, and yet he still stands firm on those issues. I would appreciate having a leader who actually appreciates sometimes when he makes mistakes and then fixes those.
You when know, when all the people showed up to vote recently in Iraq, was that a... Did that underscore the rightness or the wrongness of the Bush policy in your view?
I think that was a positive step in the Bush policy in Iraq. I don't think that vindicates the entire war on Iraq.
You know, Mike, you should have listened to Hillary Clinton a little bit closer today, because one of the things she said, that we in the Democratic Party have to become used to the notion that when something good happens, like the election in Iraq, that actually helps the United States, we can't be sad about that. We can't be distraught about that. We have to embrace these things that happen that are good for the United States, even if they are also good for the Republicans.
It's always a problem for the opposition party.
Well, it is.
I mean, the opposition party.
What I hear from Mike is saying, well, yeah, maybe the Iraq elections were okay, but there's nothing special. This is a terrific thing for the United States. It probably means fewer Americans are going to die. And Hillary Clinton is looking at this and saying, my party is going to be in deep trouble if we are continually looked at as the party that says, oh, heck, things are going too damn well in Iraq.
Charles,
I saw when on this point, I certainly agree with one thing that Marty said. When President Bush gave the State of the Union and the Republicans decided to sort of pull a very useful PR stunt of putting the dipping their fingers and show. And I thought, the Democrats' decision not to do that, which is to say to convert the idea of the successful election into a Republican victory instead of claiming it as a bipartisan victory, this is just lunacy. What you want to do as an opposition party is oppose, but you don't want to oppose mindlessly. You want to oppose on big issues where you have an alternate view. And I take Bush to be saying, when I'm not going to debate with myself, is until the opposition party comes out with a clear position that's opposed to him, why should he begin making concessions until he's in negotiations?
Mike. Yeah, you know, Marty, look, first of all, there's a misconception, okay? I'm sure there are some to the far left. I'm not naive. I know there are some to the far left who don't want anything to succeed in Iraq. They don't want any good news to come out of Iraq, because obviously that shines well on Bush. I'm not among those people. I want our troops to succeed. I want our troops to come home safely. But when you said it'll mean fewer lost lives among Americans, you know, one thing that both Senator Clinton and Senator McCain said today is this is absolutely just the beginning, and they talked about this process in Iraq taking years.
Right.
Now, I don't see the insurgents going away, and as long as there's this insurgency, there's going to be a continued loss of life among American troops,
right,
and a continued loss of life among innocent Iraqis, which is something that we tend to overlook completely in this country.
The more those insurgents look at the United States and say, there's a whole political party over there that wants us to win and the American soldiers to lose, we're going to hang in there. The thing that you want to do is demoralize the other side. And one way to demoralize them would be for them to think that Democrats and Republicans are committed to the destruction of the insurgency.
Marty, I think that that's a bit unfair to the Democrats. For example, Kerry, I don't think you supported him, but Kerry was very clear that though he would not have gone in, he was going to stay for the rebuilding. You may not have thought he was sincere and so forth, but the Democratic Party did that.
He would have had to fight his own party.
He may well have, but the standard bearers in the Democratic Party have not been nearly as defeatist on Iraq after the invasion as the way I think you were characterizing them.
Well, apparently Hillary Clinton sort of agrees with me, because her statement today was, we've got to show the American people that we're not happy when things happen. I'm maybe not quoting her correctly.
You have been a long time critic of Hillary Clinton. When you heard her today, if you would have closed your eyes, could you have voted for her for president?
Well, I didn't hear enough about her, and I guess I know too many things about her to think that. But if you were just voting on what you heard today.
That's my point.
Right.
Because a lot of people will be, and she's got 4 years to change images that are out there.
Right.
But if Hillary Clinton keeps talking like she did today, there's a lot of people who might have been professional Clinton haters. You're never going to get those. But a lot of people who were on the edge, who have heard negative things about her, that may be very difficult to stick in 4 years if she has a few more performances like she did on Meet the Press today.
I thought she was very good today, much as it hurts me to say it.
But I'll tell you that there are folks on my side of the political spectrum that understand that her husband won 2 terms partly by becoming a little bit more moderate than maybe he really was, but there's a concern that Hillary is going to take that one step further and move completely to the middle and kowtow on virtually every issue.
Do you feel about that?
Well, I don't think there's any question that we need to look. As a liberal, my heart tells me that I want the party to stay to the left. My head tells me that I want us to win a few elections. I'm tired of losing. In order to win, we've got to go a little bit more moderate to win some people over in those so-called red states. But I don't want us to kowtow on every single issue. And I don't know that I like the fact that if you closed your eyes today, you wouldn't know what party Hillary Clinton stood for.
Bruce. So then there's this split that you have, and everybody has. I mean, whether it's conservatives and Republicans or liberals and Democrats, you fight the internal battle as to whether you're a liberal or you're a Democrat. Because to be a Democrat, the goal of a Democrat, i.e. a political party, is to win.
That's right.
The goal of a liberal or a conservative is to get your philosophy made into law.
That's right.
The difficulty that the Democrats face on this particular point, you've nailed it right on the head, is that when you ask Americans, are you a liberal or are you a conservative, about 20% of the population now says that they're liberal, and about 35 to 38% say that they're conservative. So one of the problems is mobilizing your base just doesn't work as well for liberals as it does for conservatives. The second point is that liberals have not been able, over the last several elections, to put together a general viewpoint that they can get people behind. They put together an additive coalition. I'll do this for you, that for you, the next for you. Whereas Reagan and Bush, the president now, have both put together kind of large visions that are conservative visions.
How much is the antagonism between liberals and conservatives and Republicans and Democrats, how much of that antagonism and that growing intensity, how much do you put at the foot of the media, Marty? Are they egging everybody on?
Well, the media obviously operate on a cycle now that requires them to have something new every 11 minutes so that they get the next cycle and the next cycle and the next cycle. And there's a certain amount of that. If there's ever anything that's even remotely controversial, they will try to bring it up. But I think that the fundamental difference between liberals and conservatives goes deeper than just media coverage. It really reaches to the whole notion of our democratic process. The Democrats now recognize, I would argue, that they can't win elections on all of their issues. The only way they can win is in the courts. They must win essentially non-democratic victories where a judge or a couple of judges find in their favor on all of the big issues, whether it's abortion, whether it's gay rights, whether it's gun control. They're losing the popular vote. They cannot win the popular vote with their positions, so they've got to have their victories in the courts, which is why this whole filibustering thing in the U.S. Senate, particularly as regards appellate justices and Supreme Court justices, will not die.
Mike, did he figure out the big conspiracy?
There's no conspiracy. The bottom line is the Democratic Party has nobody to blame but themselves for what's happened. The Democratic Party and the people, the so-called political consultants who get paid all this money to win campaigns, did a lousy job in this past election, because what we did is the same thing we did in 2000. We let the opposition describe us. We let the opposition put the names on us, flip-flopper, all that good stuff, and that's what stuck, and the Democratic Party failed to fight back. As far as the media, the media, it's interesting what's happening to the media, because now you have this facet, these bloggers and all that, who are ready to jump on the slightest thing that the media overlooks or that the media they think gets wrong. So I think it's going to be an interesting new landscape coming up, but there's no conspiracy.
I want to talk about it. 1-800-723-8029. When we come back, we're going to talk about the United States writing the rule book for the world. Is that a good idea, bad idea? Are we better than everybody else? If so, we'll talk about it. Back shortly.
Hi, I'm David Orrick. Orrick owners know that if something ever goes wrong with their vacuum, they can call me or go into any one of my Orrick stores, and if we can't fix it the same day, we'll loan you one to use. But what if something goes wrong with one of those superstore vacuums? Who are you going to call? The cashier? What does she know about fixing vacuums? Call me at 1-800-989-4200. 1-800-989-4200.
A party at Ed's house. Okay. Will Ed's parents be there? Then the answer is no.
Making sure an adult's there isn't easy.
No, his brother being there isn't the same.
But if you don't, your kid's more likely to do drugs.
No, I don't care if he is old for his age.
Do it. It'll always be worth it. Parents, the anti-drug. To learn more, call 1-800-788-2800 or visit theantidrug.com. Sponsored by the ONDCP and the Partnership for Drug-Free America.
Sacramento, California to New London, New Hampshire. You're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. We welcome a new affiliate. It is WTIM 97.3 FM. That's in Taylorville, Illinois. And nice to welcome WTIM to the Beyond the Beltway Network this Sunday night. Joining us this evening to share their thoughts and opinions, we welcome our Liberal Democrat. He is Michael Golnick. He's a talk show host for ESPN AM 1000 in Chicago. That's a sports talk station, but he's involved in politics with the Lake County Democratic Organization. That's just a little bit north of Chicago. He's been involved in that organization since 1996. Also does a political talk show for WKRS up in Waukegan, Illinois. Marty Garrity also joins us, a longtime participant in this broadcast. He is a commercial real estate executive when he is not pontificating on the air or writing op-ed pieces for the Chicago Tribune. Charles Lipsom joins us. He is the pride of Marks, Mississippi, a professor of political science at the University of Chicago, and author of a new book called Doing Honest Work in College. We have callers on the line. Let's go to Justin, listening to us in Schaumburg, Illinois. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Bruce. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Thank you.
I'd just like to talk about the injection of religion into politics as of late.
Yes.
Legislating with faith in mind, because it appears that moral values were the highest held factor in this last election.
Uh-huh.
I don't believe that bipartisanship can happen when religion is infused with legislation. Religion in itself kind of forces a hardening of tribes, and it gives a sense that you believe in something so strongly and have faith in something, then that is right and everything else is wrong. And there needs to be some concession.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Yes.
When Martin Luther King and the black church movement in the South, joined by many churches in the North, pushed for what was one of the most important social changes of our time and pushed for legislation about it. Does the same thing apply there?
Or the Vietnam War, same thing. There was a heavily religious...
Let me tell you what's behind the question. The question is not... behind the question is the idea that it may not be religion in and of itself, but a particular way of expressing these values, a particular institutionalization of it, and so forth.
Exactly.
The simple fact is, Justin, that all law is based on moral feelings. If as a society we think that one shouldn't kill one's neighbor, we pass a law against it. It happens that that's one of the Ten Commandments. It's a religious restriction. Thou shalt not kill.
I'm in favor, Marty.
All law is essentially an expression of the collective moral opinion of the society.
Michael Golnick, your response?
Justin, you know, I think one of the things that you touched on, Justin, is that there's a reason why you're not supposed to talk about religion and politics. Those are two of the things that often break up conversations. What I don't like about what this administration has done, and maybe, Justin, this is a little bit of what you're talking about, is using morality in place of ideology. I mean, using morality to make themselves, quote-unquote, superior to the rest of us. If we don't agree with them, we don't have the same moral fiber that they do. When it comes to issues...
For instance.
Well, when it comes to issues like abortion, when it comes to issues like gay marriage, if we don't agree with them, that either makes us, you know, whatever we are, bad Christian,
but
bad Jew, whatever.
I mean, people who disagree with the liberal position on, for instance, homosexual rights are called homophobes. And in our society, that's an epithet. That is a very bad word. If you call me a homophobe, you're asserting essentially your moral superiority over my savage hatred. You're saying I'm intolerant. The same is true of abortion. The people who are pro-abortion, pro-choice if you wish, but I won't allow pro-choice, pro-abortion, look at people like me and say, you want to deprive all these women of their rights. We're superior to you because you're so uncaring about women's rights.
But
I'm sorry,
that
is...
Killers.
Yeah,
of course, that's absolutely
killers.
True. Yeah, we do.
Yeah, I mean, you have to look at it both ways.
But it's a two-edged sword.
You calling me pro-abortion as opposed to pro-choice
right.
is implying that I'm in favor of abortions, that I'm in
yes.
favor of that practice.
Yes.
Nothing could be further from the truth. I'm in favor of women making decisions over their own bodies. I'm not in favor of the practice. In fact, what I am in favor of in that issue is obviously more education and not less money going toward Planned Parenthood and things like that. I mean, what I hear from the most recent budget is the Bush administration wants to throw millions of dollars toward abstinence programs, mm-hmm. but not one cent toward educating people about their choices, about adoption, about Planned Parenthood. See, to me, again, it's and I agree with you as far as people from my side or people that don't agree calling you homophobes. There are ignorant people on both sides of the spectrum, and I think that's it doesn't matter where they come from, it's wrong. You disagreeing with me on the issue of gay rights doesn't make you a homophobe, just as me not agreeing with you on the issue of abortion certainly doesn't make me pro-abortion.
I think what you see is that these issues touch very deeply. They're hot-button issues. They touch very deeply. And what is sometimes lost in all of this is one of the great achievements of American politics, which is a sense of mutual forbearance and toleration and an ability to settle things in a political arena without demonizing your opponent.
But there is an issue that has been discussed for 20-plus years now. It's discussed at water coolers, and there's an overwhelming national support for the death penalty. It's changed a little bit in the last couple of years, but the scale is overwhelmingly for the death penalty. Democratic politicians, led primarily by Bill Clinton, he basically, as well as other local politicians as well, even though, in my view, in their heart, they oppose the capital punishment, politically, they say they're for it. Because I believe that this is where they leave their personal morality behind, and they take the popular position. And I'm wondering if there are other positions that are out there today that either the Republicans or the Democrats are going to have to swallow hard on and say, you know what, we're really opposed to this, or we're for this, and we're doing it just for political purposes. Does anybody want to offer an issue?
Well, I would say that ultimately the Democrats are going to have to come up against all of the ramifications of their unflinching support for every kind of abortion, including partial birth abortion. I mean, probably 80-85% of the population is against the execution of a baby at 8 months and 3 weeks of gestation just because his mother decides she doesn't want him anymore.
Is there a Republican issue that's out there, a conservative issue out there that you think is going to force the conservatives into maybe, or Republicans, to back away from a position?
You know, right now, unfortunately, they're in a position of strength, and I don't know that they have to back away from many of their positions, realistically speaking. I mean, the one thing that came to my mind as far as our side was also on the abortion issue, because the aforementioned Hillary Clinton recently made a speech talking about abortion and reaffirming her pro-choice stance, but then going on to add, but I completely understand what's in the hearts of those who are pro-life. So again, making an effort to position herself a little bit.
I think abortion is actually a more dangerous issue for the Republicans, because I think what's going to happen over the next several years is it's likely that that there will be Supreme Court vacancies, and if the Supreme Court vacancies mm-hmm. would, if you're replacing a conservative, if you're replacing Rehnquist, it's not a big deal. But if you're replacing somebody who would be on the side, the five side, that could flip Roe versus Wade, that's going to be a very big deal, and it's dangerous for Republicans.
During one of our earlier breaks, you said that it was a concern of yours, Mike, that the Democratic Party not become the little brother party. What did you mean by that, and how do you rectify it?
Well, what I mean by it is that right now, the Democratic Party, as I said before, is its own worst enemy. And I'm not sure that making Howard Dean the head of the DNC is doing anything to rectify that problem. We have lost touch. The Democratic Party has lost touch with a lot of the people who have voted predominantly Democratic in the past, but are more in the middle and are more won over by what they see or what they hear from the other side. And I think what you need to do is, again, you need to become a little bit more moderate in some areas. You need to swallow your pride and on some of these issues. But, you know, the bottom line is that the Democratic Party needs a brand new approach in terms of how to attract new voters and how to go out and win back the voters who have left
them. Have you got one? What is it? What's the answer?
I don't know what the answer is right now, to be honest with you. I do think that we need to frame the argument a little bit differently, and I think that we need to get away from fighting battles that, frankly, we can't win. The filibusters that you spoke of, look, I happen to agree with that. You know, we need to look at the bigger picture and understand issues that we can win on.
I think the primary process and the funding process as well, but the primary process in particular makes it very difficult. Think about a centrist Republican like a Mark Kirk. you know, how difficult it would be for figures like that on the national level who don't take the essentially the Republican line on abortion rights. Look at what happened to Tim Romer. You know, I mean, he was just essentially run off on a rail because he was not on the Democratic majority side on abortion rights. So you've got the primary process tends to solidify the more extreme views within each party.
On the other issue that I mentioned before the break, I want to talk about something we briefly talked about last week, and that is, does the United States have a unique position where they should be setting the rules for the world as it relates to who gets nuclear arms and who does not? Marty, are we the boss?
It is the responsibility of every government, first of all, before anything else, is to protect its citizens. And if the United States looks at North Korea and says there is serious risk to our citizens from the fact that these folks have the ability to drop a nuclear bomb somewhere, it has an obligation to respond to that recognition.
I want to get Mike's response when we come back. 1-800-723-8029. Taking America's political pulse from coast to coast and border to border every Sunday night on some of America's great radio stations.
More cereal, son?
Yeah, more calcium, iron, B vitamins, and other essential vitamins and minerals, please.
Maybe kids don't worry about nutrition, but they don't have to when you say.
So you want more Maltomeal?
Yeah.
My family needs a nutritious breakfast, and Maltomeal is loaded with vitamins and minerals many other hot cereals don't have, including calcium, B vitamins, and more iron, too. And my kids love it.
Mmm!
Both of them.
Maltomeal Hot Wheat Cereal in original chocolate and maple and brown sugar.
It's more of what hot cereal's for.
It's winter, and that challenges my immune system. Hey, this is Larry King, and to stay healthy, I depend on the advanced protection of Ester C. Advanced because Ester C's the only vitamin C with metabolites. Advanced because it's already in a form my body can use. So give your immune system the kind of help I give mine. Get the advanced protection of Ester C. Ester C. Are you getting advanced protection from your vitamin C?
Look for Ester C at Walgreens, GNC, and everywhere vitamins are sold.
From Austin, Texas to Boston, Massachusetts, you are listening to Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8029. Before the break, we talked about what right do we as a country have to determine who is in the nuclear club or not, And Michael Golnick was going to give his response.
We are undoubtedly the most powerful nation on earth. We are not so powerful that we can impose our will on every other nation. We need to be part of the process. We need to make sure that we play a role in determining. We can't play the role in determining. And what troubles me so much when you talk about, North Korea, I almost got the feeling that one of the reasons why North Korea spoke up and said that we've got the weapons is just to kind of let the Bush administration, we're still here, because they kind of feel ignored a little bit. The Bush administration is focused so much on Iraq and on Afghanistan that they've kind of lost sight of some of the other things that have been developing, and I kind of think that's what's happened with North Korea.
I understand that the North Koreans are too. If they didn't have the bomb, they're Myanmar. They are the Central African Republic. They're nothing. We don't even realize they're there.
Well, the problem with North Korea is that they have about 40,000 cannons pointed at Seoul, which is very close to the border. I've talked to people who were involved in planning what could have been a war in 1994 against North Korea. At the time, they thought that they could take out the nuclear issues. What they were concerned about was that Seoul would be destroyed, hundreds of thousands of people would die, and this is the case where Jimmy Carter went in and stopped the war, in effect.
What right do we have to determine who's in the club and who's not in the club? Is it just because we've got the biggest stick?
One of the lines that the Greek historian Thucydides wrote 3,000 years ago is, the strong do what they will, the weak do what they must. In this case, the United States, in its view that it wants to stop nuclear proliferation, is actually joined by virtually all the other major industrialized countries, including a number of countries like Japan that don't have nuclear weapons yet. The difference is that the United States is the only country that's in a position to project nuclear power, project military power to prevent that. What the Iraq War did, in my opinion, was it showed that it is very dangerous to try to get nuclear weapons, but it's great to have them, because it's hard for me to believe that we would have actually staged that invasion if we were confident that Saddam Hussein had 10 or 12 nuclear weapons, because we couldn't be sure that they wouldn't be used against Saudi Arabian oil fields and cut off all the world's oil.
How do we now dissuade the Iranians from moving forward, and how do we dissuade
We've got a good cop, bad cop arrangement right now. What you heard from Condi Rice last week was essentially all options are on the table. We're looking at the Europeans' negotiations with the Iranians, and you heard in the Bush State of the Union a message that basically if the Iranians want to rise up against these people, we'll support them. But it's a good cop, bad cop.
But there is an opportunity right now as the president is traveling around Europe. There's an opportunity again to hear with some clarity from European leaders that they're going to say no to the expansion of a nuclear program in Iran. They have that power.
Say that. The French,
but they have the power to do it.
But they are bought. They were bought by Saddam Hussein, and they're bought by the Iranians. The French don't care about morality or even the welfare of the United States. They care only about their own pocketbooks. And as long as the Iranians are buying Chardonnay from the French are going to be resisting our efforts to stop the Iranians.
I don't want to paint the French as being as vile as Marty. I do agree that the French don't have our best interests in mind. What I think is going to be very interesting, you've got this election, obviously, and we're going to find out who the next prime minister of Iraq is going to be. And the gentleman, I believe his name is Ibrahim Jafari, who is the favorite to win, is a longtime friend of Iran. There's the old adage, be careful what you wish for, you might just get it. We got the elections. That doesn't ensure that we're going to get the people in leadership roles in Iraq that we want.
You asked earlier how much can we do on our own. And the fact is, in Iran, the Russians are doing the supplying of the nuclear materials. They have a lot of leverage. It's the Europeans who are negotiating. I think what the United States has to do is put more pressure on the Russians, indicate that if they continue this, and Europeans put pressure on the Russians, if they continue doing this, they'll isolate themselves. With respect to North Korea, the issue is related to China.
Should the United States use its influence to try to push the Russians out of the G8? Does that make any sense?
I think it's a non-starter.
Well, in as much as the Russian, presumably the G8 means these are numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8, except that they're basically 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and about 16. The Russians are essentially a minor economy in the world today. Their basic product, apparently, is weapons for Iran.
Should they be thrown out?
I think they should.
Do you think they should be thrown out?
I don't think they should. I think that, you know, as Charles just mentioned, I think Russia right now is heading more and more toward being just completely isolated. And I think that's very dangerous. I think doing something like that further isolates them. No, I don't think so.
Charles?
I think that the Russians can't be allowed to be in a position where the major economies of the world who want to talk to each other and who are democratic are blocked by the Russians. The Russians will have to decide whether they want to put themselves in that position or not. If they do, in effect, form a blocker, then what you'll see is that they'll rule themselves out.
That was Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago, along with Michael Golnick, who's been with us in hour number one. Mike is our liberal Democrat tonight. Our conservative Republican is Marty Garrity. He is a professional real estate executive. And we thank you all for joining us in hour number one. For those listening to us on radio in hour number two, we're going to be continuing this discussion. We're also going to talk a little bit about baseball and about the hornet's nest that was really knocked apart by Jose Canseco with charges of steroid use in baseball. We're going to talk about the way that the government has responded to that, the way that baseball has responded to that, and also looking ahead to the upcoming baseball season, whether it's going to have any impact at all on the national pastime. That's coming up in hour number two of Beyond the Beltway. I'm Bruce Dumont. If you're listening to us on television, we'll see you next week. If you're listening to us on radio, we'll be back in about 10 minutes.